Simmons has started the Grandland Network.
Grandland Network.
Basically, he's rounded up some people capable of talking about sports and other stuff too, in an entertaining way, if I were to take a guess.
This is the Grandland Network.
Hello and welcome to the Hollywood Perspectives Podcast. My name is Chris Ryan. I'm a writer and an editor for Grantland.com. And on the other line, quit screwing around, Bishop. It's Andy Greenwald.
Happy to be here. It's a big day. Although I have to say, I was almost replaced for this podcast with Jake Gyllenhaal.
Oh.
Because, you know, I couldn't meet my contract demands after the first one we did.
Well, we're obviously talking about the bracket that's driving everybody mad, if not exactly a March Madness bracket. It's the Sequitology bracket on Grantland.com right now, where we are ranking or pitting some of the greatest sequels in movie history, although we may have missed some, against one another to find out the battle for the best movie sequel of all time. Andy, we have a special guest with us this week to discuss.
This is really exciting for us. This is a guest who probably should have been a guest before. He's a good friend of ours and a excellent podcast guest. Am I introducing him? Or you go.
I laid the runway. You take off.
That was beautiful. And he's being so silent. Chuck Klosterman is on the line with us. Hey, Chuck.
Hello.
Hi, Chuck.
Hey, you know, before we get into all this bracket stuff, sure. I wanted to bring something up with you fellows.
Oh boy.
You know, I listen to the podcast every week. You know, I'm a huge fan. Okay.
Thank you.
I watched a movie this weekend that I feel you guys, to a degree, both mildly undersold, but more so kind of miscategorized.
Okay, well, if you say undersold, I already know it's not Bourne.
Yeah.
It's Margaret.
Is it called, first of all, are we calling it Margaret now?
Well, that's what the guy says in the movie.
Oh.
Yeah, that's the name of the poem. That is technically correct, yes.
I think this was probably the best movie that I saw since There Will Be Blood. I can't believe that you guys indicated that it might be boring. I kind of got into it thinking that it might, you know, like you made it sound like we were going to stare at an opera singer for long stretches of time. I thought that was the fastest moving 2.5-hour movie I may have ever seen.
Well, first of all, I would interject in my defense. Chris's defense is that I don't believe he's seen it.
Yeah, that's my defense.
That's a strong
defense.
And that's
rock solid. I'll take that to court.
My defense would be, Chuck, if you watched it via Netflix or something like that, then you saw the edited version.
Well, I saw a 2.5-hour version. I'm not right sure now if this was the Scorsese cut version or what. All I know is that I like that movie so much. I'd never seen You Can Count on Me, so I watched that the next night, and that was also very good.
That's a great movie. I think that's a masterpiece. But you did see the 2.5-hour version, which is cut from the 3-hour and change version, director's cut that I saw, which I didn't find boring. I don't know if I called it boring.
Say it was boring, but I really wish I would have seen the 3-hour version now. I wonder what I'm missing.
Yeah, I would argue that if you see them to see that movie at all, you sort of need to see the full version because it doesn't. I'm surprised that you like the shorter version because I haven't seen it, but I've heard that it just doesn't function that way. That it sort of needs to be at its full.
It's really the half hour bloom. Makes that big of a difference, you think?
Apparently, I mean, I was speaking to someone else. I don't know why I'm protecting my father's identity on the podcast, who also saw the shorter version.
A man who may or may not have brought me into the world,
who sired me, and he mentioned that he really enjoyed it, and I didn't know which version he'd seen, and I asked if there was a key plot point that I shouldn't mention, but he said no, of course not. He assumed that there's a pregnancy aspect to the movie, and he thought it was all a sham, because the scene that I mentioned proves that it was not a sham. So he liked it, but felt robbed by the
Yeah, I guess I thought it was a sham in the version I saw as well. I guess the main thing I would say, though, is that I sort of thought it was going to be like, you know, that it was going to be a good movie that was going to be like Dogville or something, that it was going to be this really weird kind of experimental thing, but it's right. Like just an interesting movie. And the fact that you know, I get, what was it made, in 2002 or 3?
No, I think it was filmed
like
in 2007.
Right? 7?
6, 7.
Oh, I thought it was back further, because there is a lot of like kind of 9/11 stuff in it that I didn't even really connect to 9/11 because so much time has passed. Maybe it would have seemed more in the present tense if the movie had come out when it was supposed to. But
yeah, and I mean, I feel like we should preface this or postface this a little bit just by saying that, you know, we talked about it before. This is Kenneth Lonergan who made the movie, and he is a phenomenal playwright. So it's not like it's draggy or arty necessarily. There are a few little flourishes, but it's really well written and really entertaining. I just thought that there are moments of it that I was totally transported and I loved it. And I was like, I can't believe American movies like this aren't made anymore. It's almost 70s-esque, and it's just like complete look at humanity and in a city. And then there were parts of it where I was like, wow, this guy is really, really just really going for it in a way that is turning me off. But I appreciated the ambition. I just thought that it was sort of, I found that it sort of wildly swung from masterpiece to something
I suppose I can see that argument, but you guys were so into the new Batman movie, which is probably similar in length, and yet feels way longer than
long
this movie.
It was just
long movies.
It was the way it was sort of. You know what? Can I be honest? I don't really like Anna Paquin.
She's really good in this movie, though.
I don't doubt it. I don't doubt that she's got a lot of talent. I just, you know what I mean? Sometimes you just like, it's like certain singers' voices. Like, I don't know. I just don't want to. I don't really. I'm not like that. You'll get me really fired up when you say Anna Paquin's in a movie.
But here's the deal. She's playing a somewhat annoying teenager.
Oh, that's even better.
She's really good at that. I agree.
It really does seem, some of the, like, they have these discussions in some of their high school classes, and it's supposed to be sort of like a high school with lots of really smart kids in it. But of course, even smart high school kids are kind of dumb.
Sure.
And it's really great the way they do it.
All right, you know what? I mean, I have to check it out because basically I've been like withholding this from my girlfriend for about 6 weeks now. So we have to watch it. So I'll watch it this week.
But I feel like the only way you can sort of see the director's cut, I think, is you have to sort of like smuggle a disc from England or something. Like, I don't think the disc that everyone's getting from Netflix is the full experience.
Well, next time you go over to Marty's house, maybe he'll show you the longer version. Listen, guys, there's dozens of people who want to hear us talk about Empire Strikes Back right now. We're sitting here talking about
I am really curious.
Save it for Margaret Part 2.
This is Jacoby's worst nightmare when he stepped away from the booth for this podcast. But I'm curious, do you think it makes more demographic sense to talk about the 3.5-hour art film from 2 years ago before we talk about the sequels? Or should we have saved this for the end? I think, Chuck, you're showing a bold disregard for demographics on this. I appreciate that.
He's a kind of classic. Hey, Chuck, so let's start off with this. Before we even started laying out the bracket and all that, and before you wrote your Rickey Henderson lead-off essay for this whole endeavor, when I say the word sequel, word association, or rather movie association, what's the first movie that pops into your head?
The very first movie? It probably is The Empire Strikes Back, because that's also the first movie I ever saw in a theater.
Okay.
And I wonder if that, to a degree, impacts my feelings about sequels in general.
The first movie you ever saw was a sequel.
Yes, and that, and I also, I was a little guy when this happened. I also remember that, the beginning of The Empire Strikes Back, like with all the Star Wars movies where there's that, the exposition up front. I kind of thought that was the difference between going to a movie in a theater and seeing a movie on TV.
Huh.
That if you went to a theater, you also got this written prequel of what happened.
Right, that like A New Hope scrolled across the...
I kept going to movies and that didn't often happen again.
No, it's a shame, because Margaret probably could have used that.
But wait, that's a good point. But that's sort of interesting. Wait, Chuck, because you're saying that as a, quote, little guy going to see that movie, you had watched a lot of television before you went to the movies for the first time, right?
Yes.
So that's sort of interesting, because the thing about TV, right, is that it continues, some of it's serialized, but movies usually, or at least before we got into sequels, stood alone. So did you go to this movie and think that all movies were just continuing other movies?
I didn't think that far ahead, I guess, but I was just...
Because
I never went to Disney movies or anything like that, so I'd never... just the experience of going into a theater, I assume that, like, that, because of watching people go to movies on TV, I did think buying popcorn was also a big part of it, Like, everyone did that,
Like it was almost required.
Yeah, like, or that they gave it to you or something, and then I just kind of thought, well, this is interesting. It's like when you go to a movie, one of the upsides is that they tell you what you're going to see to a degree.
Huh.
But that doesn't really answer your question, Chris.
No, I guess it does. I mean, I think that the main point you brought up I think the main arguing, there's obviously, coming out of the brackets, there's a lot of conflicts that we see, mainly between the world of Tolkien and the world of George Lucas. But, like, the main point you brought up that I liked the most was the idea that if Godfather Part II, which some people think is the greatest American film ever made, how can that not then, by proxy, be the greatest sequel ever made, right?
It's got to be. Right. I can't see anything on this list
except
that is close to it.
Something, a xenomorph is going to bury itself in Al Pacino's throat and gestate in its stomach and come right out and explode, and then Bill Paxton is going to kill it because Aliens is the best sequel ever made.
I'd like to see that movie. I just want to go on record. That sounds fantastic.
So, I mean, so in your mind, Chuck, there's just, like, this is just, like, you know, this is basically all a big sideshow to the fact that Godfather 2 is going to waltz this.
Well, I'm not sure, I'm still not exactly positive what criteria people use in this kind of thing.
Well, you gave them freedom.
Well, I did give them freedom, but I see what you can't take it away from them. Well, that won't do any good anyway.
Yeah.
Do you think that people, when they vote in this, do you feel like they're just voting for whichever film they personally prefer, or do you think that they are attempting to sort of make a critical decision?
Well, I think it depends. I mean, I think people went into it, if they saw the list, they would have gone in with favorites. But then, you know, the nature of the bracket is that you play the direct matchups,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, right.
So you get much more heated about much smaller things or on an individual basis. You know, like, I was very, very, very into Die Hard with a Vengeance doing well in this competition, but it had no chance because it was up against, what was it up against? Chris,
Dark
do you have
Knight
the full
Rises.
List? Right, so that was not going to happen. It was going up against, you know, the biggest movie of this year. So instead, I switched my much more passionate, totally arbitrary allegiance to the fact that Spider-Man 2, which is better than the first Spider-Man and is a pretty good movie, was losing to Back to the Future 2, which is the sequel to a movie that is better than any of them, but it is in itself not a very good movie. So I get very heated just by the one-on-ones. I don't think that I was thinking the long game here.
Back to the Future 2 is the future one or the Old West one?
The hoverboards.
Gotcha.
Now, Chris, because you're in L.A., you might be able to answer this question. Because I wrote that intro piece,
yes.
Everyone is tweeting at me about this. I think that they somehow, some people seem to assume
that you were
did this.
You were the
now,
Swami. Yeah.
So here's the question I have. Did we just forget to put the Road Warrior on this, or did it not get enough?
No, there was voting. There was internal voting, and, like, you can see a lot of that voting and the debate going on in the emails that we published on the Prospectus blog. But to be completely honest, I didn't notice Road Warrior.
I don't remember seeing it or anything about that. And that probably
but actually,
was
you know, I think
you're,
I mean, I think generationally speaking, Road Warrior is kind of like for you and me. That's a very important movie, but I do not think it's made. And I could be corrected on this, but I don't think it's made the leap into future generations. I don't think a lot of people are like, Mad Max is really cool.
Okay, but how does that factor into what movies get selected, though? Are we consciously
trying
to make
it more applicable? Oh, no, I'm just saying that even had it made the bracket, I would not be surprised to see it lose to something like, say, Toy Story 3, because I don't think that a lot of people have seen it, comparatively.
Do you think fewer people have seen it than Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey?
I don't know. I don't
yeah,
or Jackass Number 2 or some of these other ones? I don't know how they got in there. Or like the second Naked Gun movie?
Well, I'm shocked that there's
stood the test of time?
And National, I don't think there needs to be... I don't think both National Lampoon's Vacations warrant entry. I mean, I can totally get both Indiana Jones's and the two Batman sequels, but I don't really understand why we need Christmas Vacation just to
get
stopped.
Wait, I mean, let's to go bigger than all this, I mean, I think that we all know that the number one defining trait of all brackets, especially pop culture ones, is that they are a little bit arbitrary. And Road Warrior was on the master list on our endless email chain that we for some reason published onto the internet. And as far as I know, there was a top secret voting that went on actually in the office after we had winnowed it down to something or other, and they just pretty much went with that. So, you know, that's why some movies that I was, you know, I'm sort of shocked that there are no Bourne movies on there. I feel like, you know, there didn't need to be multiple sequels from the same franchises on the list, but, you know,
did Bill have extra points or something?
Not to my knowledge.
Because why is Rocky IV a 2C? Well, that makes no sense at all.
You'd have to ask him. I can't.
So you're not denying it, after
No, no. I just mean. Like, I just think
are,
that.
Are
like,
you willing to deny this, Chris? Will you deny this, or will
Chuck,
you say nothing?
I'm pleading the fifth.
Speaking of sequels, Chuck is like the bane of this whole thing.
Yeah, you really are. You're trying to bring chaos into our lives and overthrow the government.
As Alfred Pennyworth once said, "Some men just want to watch the world burn."
Is that his last name, Pennyworth?
Is that? Whoa! I really just. You know, I'm just going to retire quietly from this podcast now.
You know what's been the most fascinating thing reading the comments here is, and I think given the our shared sort of generation, this isn't really much of a conversation starter, but I can't believe that there's this much debate about whether Lord of the Rings as a franchise is up against Star Wars as a franchise. And it's really interesting, though, to see people knock Star Wars or use, you know, to promote Lord of the Rings based on, like, its superior technology.
Yes.
And, like, the better special effects, as if... First of all, I actually prefer the special effects in Star Wars to the CGI stuff. I think that's just... That's personal taste. But it's really interesting. I mean, people are, like, absolutely, like, appalled that Empire and Return of the King were seated against each other.
Yeah, is this a generational thing? What is up with this, Chuck?
And that CGI technology thing is interesting, because here's something that I honestly don't know the answer to. Is it easier or more difficult to use CGI effects for the creative person?
That's a good question.
Because, you know, like with Star Wars, they were, you know, in order to have, you know, when there'd be an explosion in space and it feels like the sparks are falling at you, they had to, like, put the models on the ceiling on a string so that the sparks would fall down. It was really creative thinking. Now, still, we could probably replicate that in our house. We could not replicate CGI effects on our Macintoshes, I don't think.
I think you could do some, though. I think that there's some minor, like, I mean, the big thing you have to have is a green screen, and I think that is like a, I mean, obviously none of us are special effects supervisors, but
Speak for yourself.
How is that obvious? Yeah.
I mean,
these people don't know us, Chris. They don't know what we do, but the point being that, like, on the MacBook Air that I'm using,
we weren't stop motion animators. I just
that's true.
No, but my point is that, like, I think that once you have a green screen, there's a certain amount of the whole thing gets democratized, right? And then you're only as good as your special effects artist. If any special effects artists want to march on down to Grantland Plaza and come on the show and correct me, that's fine. But I think that, like, the green screen is sort of like, okay, as long as we have that, we can put, Matt Damon can be in front of the pyramids or the Eiffel Tower or whatever, right?
Yes. I mean, nope. I don't know. Right.
Okay,
I mean,
using the example we're faced with, if we were now making The Empire Strikes Back and, like the Snowwalker scene, would that be super easy now with CGI? Would that be, like, problem whatsoever?
It would be expensive, and you'd have to have, you know, there actually are creative people who have to storyboard and draw and design these things and animate them. But
right.
I guess there are two questions. There's the question about the creativity of it, you know, and there's certainly, we've seen examples of CGI that have been incredibly creative and visually breathtaking. And then there's the fact that, like, in the MacBook Air that I am using to look at the internet has, you know, more computing power than Industrial Light and Magic had for all of the Star Wars movies put together, probably by a factor of like 100, right? So it's just a question of what you do with it. And I do think, and Chris, we talked about this last week, we were talking about action movies, that I think that it's become sort of a crutch. The fact that you can just illustrate anything
you want, almost, or animate.
But I actually was I was sort of interested in the generational conflict that was coming up in the comments between Star Wars and Lord of the Rings fans, where people were like, you know, basically saying, like, this is our trilogy, you know, this is, you know, the older people like Star Wars, but this one is so much better, it's so much richer.
This is the coolest argument to have.
For sure. But I mean, first of all, like, I am not a big Tolkien stan, but, like, I would say that he's probably
Stan
a better...
Tolkien was like a
Stan,
short Stan,
Stan, Stan
Red,
Tolkien
right?
was a great guy. He's actually a steam fitter down in my neighborhood. But the point being, like, that guy could write a sentence better than George Lucas ever could. That is not really up for debate, I don't think. But I would argue about the generational thing only because, and again, I am not going to protect the identity of people we know in real life, but our friend and occasional Grantland contributor, John Dolan, told me a story about how his son, who is, what, like five years old, a little bit older now, has never seen the Star Wars movies, but came home telling his parents about them in great detail because the other 4 and 5 year olds on the schoolyard in 2011 or 12, whenever this was, constantly were talking about them. Now, he had all of the facts wrong. He apparently came home and told them that Obi-Wan Kenobi was, quote, a really bad guy.
Yeah, it's interesting. He got like John's mom or whatever has some of these old Star Wars figures. So the kid is playing with these and kind of creating his own narrative. It's very interesting. Like, I think Chewbacca's bad to him, too, maybe.
You were playing that that chess game with Chewbacca, he is bad. I mean, from anybody's perspective, you know, maybe this kid's just Rashomon-ing it.
Chris, that's fascinating. Well, but look, here's another argument that we're making right now. Just by having this supremely nerdy conversation, are we debating the storytelling power of a franchise or actually the quality of the sequels? And that, those are two different conversations. And again, I feel like that's why Back to the Future, for example, is beating Spider-Man.
Interesting.
I'll just drop the mic. I'll just walk out. I walk out of this podcast.
Well, I think that's an interesting point. Like, the whole thing here is criteria. Like, in past brackets we've had, I think that you could really, like, you know, The Wire one really played into, as did the Super Bowl, played into people's personal preferences, whereas this one seems to be asking you to define exactly what you feel like a successful sequel is. Like, I'm looking at this list now, right, and some of my favorite movies here actually are not very good sequels. Like, I don't think The Color of Money, it's a fantastic movie, but I don't know if you could really call that a good sequel, could you?
Well, what criteria?
Because a lot of time had passed. Considering how much time
One of the most inventive sequels ever in that sense, because it actually picks up a character, 40 years later? 30 years later?
Would be 40.
25, I think.
25, 40.
I think like Paul Newman is 26 or whatever, supposedly, in the first one, and he's 46 in the next one.
Okay. And I mean, that movie is arguably, like, dramatically, at least, like, maybe one of the most three or four accomplished ones on the bracket. But it's going to get stomped by Khan because, A, because it's Khan, and B, because I think Star Trek II was part of a... It was like, you know, Star Trek II is like, here's this arc, but each movie is its own separate thing, right?
Right, and I think that's sort of weird because I get the point you're making, but that's also an example of the strange thing we're up against, where The Hustler was, you know, a masterpiece, and The Color of Money was an interesting movie that existed on its own terms, not just as a sequel, whereas, you know, Star Trek was sort of presaging where we are now, where we're just dealing with, like I was saying, with franchises. So the whole point is it's supposed to be sequential. There's going to be many chapters in the story where nothing essentially ever changes. And I don't know, do people really like Wrath of Khan that much? I was really riding hard for Star Trek IV, which I think is a better sequel.
Is that the Whales one?
It's the Whales one because it's so weird and funny and interesting, and it's proof that you can actually do something.
Two and four are both okay. The main thing is, okay, we got a Star Trek movie against The Color of Money. There are people who like Star Trek so much that they would vote for Star Trek III against that. Like, they're just looking at the board and they're like, I associate or I identify liking Star Trek, I'm going to vote for it. There's not people who are like, I love billiard movies. And anytime I see a movie about billiards, I'm going to vote for it. So Star Trek could do all
are
right.
Are there any other billiard movies?
That's a really good question.
Not really.
Yeah.
Yeah, so Chuck, that was a total straw man argument.
Yeah.
Well, there is no person like that. I mean, it wouldn't matter. If it was up against, you know, Toy Story 3, I don't know if there's a contingent of people who are into animated toy-based movies or whatever, but there are definitely people who support Star Trek kind of across the board. Whatever situation they're, you know. Star Wars is the same way.
I wonder if there's a name for such diligent, passionate Star Trek fans.
Yeah, if only there was a way to sort of just group them into some sort of rubric.
Chuck, just, you know, doing a little bit of prognostication here, moving forward with your idea that there are these, you know, Star Trek adherents or whatever, let's call them Trekkies just for the sake of argument, what do you think about Star Trek Wrath of Khan's chances against Dark Knight in the second round?
That's a pretty popular movie.
Which one?
The Dark Knight.
Yes, it is a popular film.
Dan Fairman thinks it's going to win the whole pool.
Yeah, I would say that the same generational split that's happening between the Lord of the Rings movies and the Star Wars movies might get played out again with Godfather Part II fans versus the Dark Knight fans, because people... And Chris, this came up when we talked about the new Batman movie, but people take this movie extremely seriously, not only because it's a good movie with an incredible performance in it, which it is, but because it's sort of, people hold it up as if it justified, you know, a lifetime of geekery and of interest in this sort of comic booky stuff, you know, that it was the first movie to cross over and become considered a mainstream quality film in a certain level. And I think also people think it's the, you know, people definitely would make the argument that it's the best sequel of all time. People in a different way than Godfather Part II, because there's a contingent of people who think Dark Knight is a masterpiece and don't think much of Batman Begins.
In the, I guess it would be, if we're looking at this bracket as a map, in the southeast region, I kind of feel like your movie, Chris, Aliens, kind of got the Duke seed.
Yeah.
There's nobody else there to beat it.
I mean, I would be more nervous if it was up against Last Crusade than Temple of Doom.
Yes, Last Crusade is a
I think Temple
much
of Doom has
movie.
Like one cool scene where he tears the guy's heart out.
Yeah, well, here's the other thing that I got tweeted at me about 9,000 times. Okay, the fact that Temple of Doom is a prequel, should that have made it ineligible?
I mean,
because it is a sequel. I mean, technically it's a sequel. They made a movie and they made another one, but because it's set a year before the other movie.
Oh, Chuck, someone was arguing this about Godfather Part II because of the De Niro scenes are technically a prequel.
Well, now that who made that argument? That's
an
idiotic.
Internet commenter, I'll have you know, Chuck. I'm sure he's a big fan of billiards.
I feel like
all
I'm talking
forms.
To Will McAvoy and Will McAvoy's brother right now.
Yeah, I think Aliens has a clear path.
Yeah, Aliens is going straight to New Orleans if that's where the Sequitology Final Four is being held. I am sad. The biggest heartache I took, Andy, I know that you were very disappointed that that Toby and Kirsten didn't make it out of the first round. I personally was pretty bummed out about the loss of Bad Boys 2 to Rocky 2.
Yeah. By the way, is there a Rocky sequel that is not in this tournament? I just want to double check that.
Can I be real with you guys? Is there a Rocky movie that's not stupid? Seriously? Like, I know that I just saw The Expendables 2, and I respect what Rocky did for Philadelphia. But,
sure.
I mean, really?
The first movie's good.
It's okay. Isn't the second movie pretty much the first movie remade?
Well, yes. the first movie, the end of it, they use music really well. I feel that I'm not a very emotional person, but I feel that the end of the first Rocky is weirdly emotional. I don't even like thinking about it.
Really?
Yeah.
Huh. Hmm. That's a tender spot. We didn't know we were going to get to a turn like that on this podcast.
The third Rocky film is... Well, this is something that I think comes up in these kind of podcasts a lot. I like to think of the Rocky franchise like... If Rocky had been a real boxer, what would be remembered as his greatest fight?
Four.
It would have to be when he fights the Russian, right?
Yeah, right? Yeah.
Especially with the idea that the Russian had killed Apollo Creed. I think that his fight
he
with
ends the Cold
Lang,
War.
When he fights Mr. T, that would be like in Ali's career, some fight against like Ken Norton or something like that. Like it would have been just this totally forgotten.
Yeah, that would have been like it's like beating the Marlins or something like that in the World Series. It's like nobody's going to remember that. Or the Marlins winning the World Series. Nobody's.
Yeah, I was gonna say the Marlins don't lose World Series.
That's true. I would go as far to say that, in terms of just movies that I would watch again in the next 2 weeks, I would sooner watch Ghost Protocol again than Rocky III.
That was like the seventh.
That was supposed to be a Molotov cocktail. It didn't really start a fire, I guess, but.
There actually, to be totally honest, there aren't a lot of movies on this list that if somebody said you got to watch one of these tonight, I'd be very excited about.
You just watched Margaret. You wouldn't be excited to watch Godfather Part II?
I'd watch that. I'd probably watch The Empire Strikes Back again.
When's the last time you saw Aliens?
It was on TV relatively recently. I forgot Paul Reiser's in that movie.
Yeah, Paul Reiser is excellent in that movie.
That is the apex of his career.
Yeah.
No, actually,
I beg to differ. He is absolutely scene-stealing in Beverly Hills Cop 1.
I agree. And also, for those who haven't seen Aliens but have seen Avatar, he plays the Giovanni Ribisi role in Aliens.
Yes.
Pretty much.
If you've seen Avatar, not Aliens...
You should probably
tear your eardrums out.
So, Chris, if you're this huge Aliens fan, I guess this is a question for both of you. Are you guys generally kind of in the tank for James Cameron?
No, I think the Terminator movies are pretty stupid.
Yeah, I'm not a big Cameron fan. I like The Abyss.
You're so ridiculous.
The Abyss is good. What's wrong with liking The Abyss?
You said you like The Abyss.
Who doesn't like The Abyss?
Me.
Okay, who else on this podcast doesn't like The Abyss?
That's the one where, like, there's, like, water you can breathe, right?
It's like Ed Harris is real intense. Yeah. Who else
and
is in that movie?
My girl, Mary Elizabeth Mastrantonio.
Why don't you choose the true Mary Elizabeth Mastrantonio performance, which is Color of Money?
Color of Money, but,
you know.
She gets
busy with Paul Newman in that, and she manipulates Tom Cruise.
That was a Paul Reiser-esque zenith for Mary Elizabeth Mastrantonio.
Yeah, that really is the Burke of her career.
I don't remember what we're arguing about right now. What?
Chuck was just saying, are we in the tank for James Cameron? And I'm saying, I respect him. And I actually think that Alien could just be like 52 minutes long and you could just cut the Newt part out. In fact, cut Ripley out and just make an entire movie about Michael Biehn and Bill Paxton. And that might be better than Godfather 2.
Bad Boys 3.
Yeah. But I'm generally not like over the moon about Cameron.
Is this, don't you think, like, I'm looking at this as we all are at this bracket, like, I feel like there's a really interesting divide, and it'll be very interesting, actually, to see how this plays out, that there are precious few movies on this list, I think, that are just, like, legitimately great films in and of themselves, right? I mean, that's sort of the argument we're making for maybe The Dark Knight, for Godfather 2, for Aliens. A lot of the other ones, I mean, just your total enjoyment of them depends
on
everything.
Well, I would argue Die Hard with a Vengeance is a great movie.
I would argue that too. Thank you. Let's get to that. But I feel like, again, you know, it's such a hard thing because I think some people, as Chuck said, we're sort of going in circles. But I think, Chuck, you were right when you were like, some people are going to go into this voting for what they think to be greater works of cinematic art, and other people are voting for the experience of being a fan of a series or seeing things continued or changed in some ways. And those are two different ways to experience movies, right?
I agree.
Thank you. Oh, that's all I wanted out of this. I just wanted some validation. But Chris, should we get into Die Hard with a Vengeance?
Just briefly talk about what might be the most underrated film on this bracket, right?
Yes. It's already gone, by the way. Already voted out by America.
I don't think it's the most underrated film on this bracket.
Well, that's so what is Ocean's 13 yours?
Superman 2.
Ooh.
As a strong 60, point. I think it's going to beat the driving movie, and then it might beat the other movie. It's going to go against the Terminator. That's a pretty good movie.
It will go against T2. That would be T2. Superman 2 is something I would stay home to watch. Like those two clashing, you know.
Yes, and I would also watch them both.
Yeah,
I'd
also
fighting.
Watch the movies, not just
Superman 2 is really. Good
I would
movie.
Actually stay home to watch these votes tally, though.
I feel like I have to do that on Thursday night if I'm writing about it the next day.
I think Die Hard with a Vengeance might be one of the three or four. No, that's a really arbitrary way of saying this. I would say Die Hard with a Vengeance is one of my favorite New York movies ever made.
I would agree. I would also say one of the things that makes that movie good is that, you know, obviously we are all, I hope, Chuck, in the tank for the first Die Hard. It is a great movie. And then with the second one, when it was just Die Hard in an airport, then all of a sudden every action movie for those next like 5 to 7 years was Die Hard in a whatever. So we had Under Siege on a boat, we had Speed 2, which was what, Under Siege and Die Hard on a boat. But what they did with Die Hard with a Vengeance was they took an existing action script that people really liked and they just basically put John McClane into it.
Yeah.
Which was very smart because it was actually
called Simon Says, right?
Yeah, it was a good and clever script, and then it was made even better because you had familiar characters in it, and you had Jeremy Irons and with his frosted tips.
Wait, in Die Hard with a Vengeance, is there an albino in that movie?
Is he albino?
Because I had a friend in college who had albinism.
Okay.
And he was actually involved, like, he used to get these newsletters from, like, this national organization that would often point out negative depictions of people with albinism in films. And I feel like Die Hard with a Vengeance was always one of the key, like, threats to the albino community.
Well, I know that in Lethal Weapon, Gary Busey is referred to as albino, but I do not believe he is, although I would say that he would be a negative portrayal of albino.
Yes, in Lethal Weapon, that's correct. The Google search, which I know is definitive, to Die Hard with a Vengeance, albino, is not really giving us the results we desire.
Maybe I'm wrong.
You
maybe
use commas
maybe I'm
in your Google searches. We learned that today, though.
I didn't, actually. I just thought it would sound better said out loud. I'm a fraud.
Who is the country music singer who plays the girl with the scythe in Die Hard with a Vengeance?
Oh, so good. It's such a good question. I'll just be stat boy for this podcast.
I was in love with her.
Yeah, she doesn't speak, right?
No.
She just cuts people.
Because didn't Mossad like cut her tongue out or something like that?
Oh,
am I making that up?
I feel like our version of this movie is so much better. But Chris, can you give while I Google this with a comma? Can you just briefly explain what you meant by it being such a good New York movie?
Yeah, totally well, agree. In case you have not or haven't recently seen Die Hard with a Vengeance, the premise is basically that Hans Gruber's brother...
It's not Hans Gruber, it's Hans Gruber.
Gruber. But, I mean, come on.
Hans Gruber is what we're going to start calling you, man.
Hans Gruber's brother, Simon, gets in the mix, and he gives... holds basically New York City hostage, and he threatens to blow up various parts of it if Bruce Willis's John McClane character does not complete a series of tasks taking place all over the city. He's only allowed to use get there by foot or by, like, he's not allowed to drive to any of these tasks, so he has to, like, get from 8th Avenue to 1st Avenue in X amount of minutes or whatever. He's being helped by a very angry man named Zeus, played by Samuel L. Jackson, which might be Samuel L. Jackson's preeminent Deep Blue Sea performance, I would argue.
Such an angry man named Zeus. That's such a great part for him to play.
And it's great. They rob Wall Street. There's like a dam explosion or a near dam explosion. It's just a great movie, but there's just a lot of, like, crisscrossing New York City and stopping bombs from going off outside of cafes and diners and stuff like that.
And it features, as you said, Chris, the sort of coffee house folk singer Sam Phillips,
yes,
as Katya, a mute female terrorist.
Chuck, your silence is deafening.
I don't remember anything about this movie. I did see it in the theater, but I just have no memory whatsoever. I thought it was in Los Angeles.
No, it's the L.A.
I thought that the first one was in L.A. and the second one's about him taking a flight on, like, Christmas.
The second one, he's trapped at Dulles, right?
No, I thought it was LAX, wasn't it?
No, the second one's D.C. because it's snowing.
Oh, it's snowing, that's right.
A lot of snow.
It's a Christmas, like the first one, right?
Yeah, and then the third one is in the summer in New York City. And then the fourth one doesn't exist.
The fourth one does not exist. Let's just all agree on that.
I don't know. Do you guys have anything else you want to say about the sequels? I mean...
Didn't you mention that you had some list of eight sequels that
did not
happen?
Oh, yeah, let's hear these, Andy.
Oh, yeah, okay. All right, so basically, we were talking about sequels, and we are in a world right now where sequels are basically the only things that get made, or sidequels or reboots or whatever. But it was interesting, again, with a little thing I like to call Googling, to look up some other movies that almost got sequels that maybe it's a good idea that they did not happen. Mm. So, okay, so you guys are just going to jump in on these. We think good idea or bad idea, right?
Okay.
The first one is a movie called 8, and the G is the number 8, and it's a sequel to 7. It would have starred Morgan Freeman.
That would have been a bad idea.
Good idea. Always wanted to know what his retirement was like.
All right. Next.
Can we safely assume that these sequels are being handled by the creative team in charge of the original movies?
Okay, well, there's actually some follow-up.
Well, wait a second.
Says,
I guess, could Brad Pitt have been in 8?
Yeah. I bet, that would be a classic Brad Pitt cameo. Like, they go visit him at the mental asylum.
I mean, let's give credit where credit is due here. This is from a website called Cracked.com, mm-hmm. The former humorous magazine, now a website. And the title of the post, this is from February, it's 6 insane sequels that almost ruined classic movies. So the idea here was that 8 was... So basically what happened with 8 was that there was a screenplay that already existed by Ted Griffin, I think, who wrote Ocean's 11.
Wow.
About a clairvoyant doctor who helps the FBI, and then the studio had it rewritten to be a sequel to 7, and Morgan Freeman was now a psychic.
You know what would have been a great title, though? 7-2:9.
Chuck, you've got a career in marketing. I like it. All right, but apparently David Fincher was sent the script and responded by saying, quote, it makes no sense.
He responded
I'm sure that
by
never...
doing 75 takes of him saying no.
Totally. I'm also sure that's never happened before. I'm sure he never sent a script that makes no sense. It's the first time it ever happened in Hollywood history. All right, 2, there was supposed to be an ET2 called Nocturnal Fears, which sounds very dirty. I mean, apparently more aliens come to Earth. Oh,
no,
Chuck,
no.
I'm reading this description. Chuck, it says that the aliens come to Earth, and they look just like E.T., except they're albino and evil.
Oh, my
so
God.
So your friend would have hated this movie.
Yeah, he really would have. E.T., are you guys big E.T. people?
Not really.
It's an anti-science movie. It's just...
Henry Thomas is good in that movie. Drew Barrymore is good in that movie.
That's the first movie.
Actually, I'm in on E.T. Let me reverse course.
You guys, that's the first movie I ever saw in the theater, and it was so scary, the part where he screams. That was really scary to me. That was very traumatic.
Started my love affair with peanut M&Ms. Reese's Pieces, sorry.
It was Reese's Pieces. Also, Chuck, you are clearly not very emotional because you gave me nothing just then. I was like, that was traumatic to me. You're silent.
Well, you were young. Silent. You were a young man wearing your first ascot, probably.
You were in a Wes Anderson movie? What's the next one?
I think I was wearing a beret. Okay, Forrest Gump 2, Gump and Company.
Doesn't Forrest Gump 1 end pretty definitively?
Yeah, were they going to have add him also like, oh, here's other historical events I forgot to mention I was
awesome
involved with?
They added him to the future, though.
Like he was like in the Bay of Pigs or something, too. And it's like...
No, you guys, there was a book. The author of the original Forrest Gump book wrote a sequel to capitalize on the movie, the first movie. And again, this is coming from the internet, so it might not be right. I'm just going to put that out there. But apparently among the events in the book or the story was that Forrest Gump would dance with Princess Diana, help bring down the Berlin Wall, and this is a quote from an internet website, end up in the backseat of O.J. Simpson's white Bronco.
What?
Well, that sounds a little more
Chuck's
promising.
In on this now. I mean,
with that plot description, I would want to see it to believe it.
Here's the best part. The movie was going to end with Forrest at the Oklahoma City bombing. Ugh. But then, before it got made, 9/11 happened, and this is a quote, Robert Zemeckis then decided the movie, quote, wasn't relevant anymore. Up to that point, it had been.
So what's the next one?
Okay, Beetlejuice 2, Beetlejuice Goes Hawaiian.
That's not really a thing.
Apparently, I don't know.
No.
Do people want more Beetlejuice?
I didn't see the first one.
Interesting gaps in your you,
there really? Is, yeah. There's yeah, just some a weird gaps in there. I bet I would like it. I like Michael Keaton.
There was meant to be a Casablanca 2.
Oh, I've heard that. I've
Who's
going to
be
that?
In that?
Apparently it would be this, I'm just reading this, that Humphrey Bogart's character Rick was actually a Nazi fighting American spy all along.
Okay.
And apparently Bogart actually signed up.
Oh. Hmm.
And then finally the one that really did almost come close, and you guys I'm sure have read about this rumored to be the craziest script in recent Hollywood history was Gladiator 2.
Yes.
Which Nick Cave, the Australian rock star, wrote. And it was basically about the gladiator character being restored to life by Roman gods and being an immortal, and then fighting his way through every war in history.
Oh, I thought it was Gladiator Goes to Hell, and he has to fight his way out of hell.
That would be a radical departure from the first film.
That would be pretty... Either one
but
would
I feel
be
like
awesome.
That's sort of... I mean, how do you guys feel? I feel like in general, these are all supposed to be so crazy, but I feel like if you're going to make a sequel, and clearly studios are dead set on making sequels to most movies, then why not just do something super weird, right? I mean, one thing I actually admire, and this is not weird, but I do sort of admire about the Mission Impossible series, is that each one is given to a completely different director, so they can sort of make their own style of movie.
No, I mean, it's a director with a very distinct visual style, De Palma and John Woo. And J.J. Abrams.
And Brad Bird, whose distinct style was cartoons up
it's
to that point.
Interesting, though, because when you do that, like, okay, remember the sequel that came after Silence of the Lambs with...
With Edward Norton.
What?
You mean Hannibal?
Yeah, with your guy at Norton.
Yes. Yeah, you know, that was an example of where the second story was much crazier than the original story. Like, at one point, I think someone, like, they feed someone's body to hogs or something in, like, a dungeon.
Yeah.
But because it was so crazy...
No, isn't someone eating Ray... Yeah. So, go ahead.
No. I feel like if you make a sequel that's just too insane, even though I understand why you'd say, like, you might as well try that, doesn't it then seem more like a cash grab?
Well, they all are, though, aren't they? I mean...
I know, but the idea is not to appear as such so overtly. Like, The Dark Knight does not seem like a cash grab.
Well, I think that, I mean, in recent memory, the most... Yeah, you're right about Dark Knight, and I think that the most recent example of a movie that even though I think it received mixed reviews, even though I think I liked it more than Andy and probably more than you, Chuck, was Prometheus, because... They could have made a very straightforward Alien sequel.
Right.
Yeah. It would have been... I think if somebody went into that movie having no idea it was related to aliens, that would not have been a problem.
Right.
Although, would the end have been kind of a problem? They would have been like, I don't... I mean, we won't get into super spoilers, but they basically would have been like, what is the significance of these events that are occurring? Like, it didn't really connect anything that happened in that movie before.
Yeah, it would have been actually pretty super weird to, like, just be like, what is the deal of these... Like, what's the importance of all this?
I mean, wouldn't it be really interesting, though, to make a prequel to a well-known film and surprise people by showing that it's a prequel at the very end. That up until that point, they thought it was just a separate
movie. Like, so you make something about... Like, you make something about, say, like, Vito Corleone, or you make a, like, a Godfather prequel or a Mission Impossible prequel, but at the very end reveal that it's a prequel.
Oh, yeah, or a kid is growing up, you know, the story of you guys growing up in Philadelphia, it's kind of a coming-of-age story, but then it turns out your best friend
is Vin
ends
Diesel.
Up being Rocky.
Oh.
You know, like that or something, you know, it's a...
Well, that clearly it would be obvious in the beginning, though, because Chris's best friend would not be wearing an ascot in any of the scenes.
I think we've...
The only other thing I'll say... Wait, I have one last point. One last point to make about this. I feel like it's... One thing that's worth remembering, especially because people get super cynical about all the sequels that get made all the time as just being purely cash grabs or being, you know, studio just needs to keep the... Like, we have the Spider-Man movie getting rebooted just because Sony wants to keep the intellectual property, which is probably, like, the worst reason ever to make a movie. But it's worth noting that even when people who you admire and who have made classic movies, they themselves want to be involved with continuing the story, they have a story in mind, good things don't always come of it. And I was thinking specifically of Chinatown, which I think is, I would argue, is, you know, maybe one of, if not the greatest American movie of all time. There was a sequel to it made called The Two Jakes, mm-hmm. and Robert Towne, who wrote both, intended to make a third one, too. Like, he really had an idea for a story, and many of the principals, not Polanski, obviously, but were involved in The Two Jakes, and The Two Jakes is not a very good movie.
Has a really great trailer, though.
It does have a very good trailer.
Go watch the trailer online. Jack Nicholson exhales from a cigarette in an extremely cool way.
Wow. I would say if you remember the trailer to a movie this long, then it's done something right, honestly. That's pretty remarkable.
I believe I saw it. I think it was the trailer to Days of Thunder.
Two Jake's trailer was also very big on VHS cassettes. I feel like a lot of VHS cassettes had the Two Jake's trailer for like a year. Because I was just like, I don't understand the relevance of this movie. I had never heard of Chinatown.
Yeah, I mean, I can see this image in my mind right now as we're talking
about
it.
We'll have to put that up in the post we do about this this podcast.
I will. I also think that we're hitting the point that Peter Jackson reaches in all of his movies where he's like, you know what? We'll just make two or three movies out of this one movie because we've shot so much footage. That's literally what we've done talking about sequels.
Well, let's start talking about the smaller screen then. And no sequels here. It's we're very much coming to the end of this storyline as we can feel it. We're talking about Breaking Bad. And, Chuck, you're a big Breaking Bad fan.
I am. I was curious. Do you feel that Walt's reference to doubling down in this episode was Vince Gilligan saying to you, thank you for your support?
Well, he would have to thank Andy, because I feel like I've been more in and out on this half season than Andy. I mean, Andy's loving every moment. I felt like this has just been... I mean, I think we all knew that this was coming, but this move from Mr. Chips to Scarface... He's almost sticking the landing too much. It's almost taking away any of like the surprise to it for me, or like the organic like liveliness of the show. Not that it was ever that lively of a show, I guess.
Well, maybe you even mentioned this in your recap, Andy. I can't remember, but I was a little disappointed in this most recent episode because when I heard that they weren't letting any of the critics see the episode early,
right.
And I heard that there was going to be a press conference, they were doing a press conference the next day, I thought something really dramatic was going to happen. I was certain Skyler was going to die. And then when it ended up being Mike, it was like, well, I guess that's shocking.
That's interesting. I think that you're definitely onto something, which is, like, the watching of TV has become such a, you know, 24/7 thing, and people are so voracious and tuned into, you know, the conversation continues long after the episode is over, and people are very much aware of what certain things mean, so that I feel like AMC almost made a mistake by not making this episode available to critics, not only because it made my Sunday night and Monday morning extremely difficult, but because I don't think any critics are going to spoil anything. And I think that, exactly as you said, just by the fact that that got out, you know, when people like, I don't know if I may have said something, I know Alan Steppenwall was like, just FYI, like my review won't be up, you know, in normal time because I don't have the episode, that immediately sends off alarm bells now. People know that means that something, quote, big is going to happen in this episode. So
well,
I feel like
and
that affects...
And I thought the press conference particularly made me think... I mean, I don't even know what ended up happening at this. Maybe
did
they
actually
just
have a press conference, or did they just do a bunch of interviews? That seems sort of crazy that you would have, like, a press conference about Breaking Bad.
I don't know how it works. I know it's pretty clear that something is going on among some publicists and some reporters because, like, every time a character dies on another show, and we won't spoil them, but... you know, a site like Vulture, which definitely puts up a lot more content than Grantland does, for example, they always have the interview ready to go the next day. Mm-hmm. So they're definitely in some sort of collusion about that. We weren't, well, I mean, a little bit. I mean, I can only speak for myself. Like, no one said anything to me about what was going to happen. I didn't know if there was a press availability or conference. They just said that it wasn't available. It's also possible that AMC still hates me because of the killing, so that just might be my own problem. But
yeah, I don't think that really happens. Because I don't think that even writing about shows negatively stops people from watching them. I mean, if that's the case, they're not thinking as publicists.
I agree with that. I agree with that. But anyway, but to your larger point, it's interesting. I thought you were going to say that you felt that it was ruined, that you, because you knew a death was happening, but it sounds like, Chuck, you were expecting even bigger fireworks.
Yeah, I thought something really dramatic was going to happen because it was the penultimate episode of this sort of juncture, and that's usually when something big happens, and I guess that Mike's death will be the big thing. There was something oddly predictable about the way it played out. Or do you disagree with me?
I totally agree. I thought that this was... I wrote last week about how it was now inevitable that Mike was going to go. I think that even in his interviews, and Jonathan Banks has done some really good interviews today about what happened to his character. They're very funny. You should check them out, people who are listening. But I think even he said he knew he was going to go. I mean, it's pretty clear that, you know, it wasn't unintentional that when Walt is watching Scarface earlier in the season, he says everybody dies in this movie. So
I thought for a little while there during the confrontation scene between Jesse and Walt in the lab that Jesse might buy it, because I just felt like the argument about money was going to go somewhere bad, or that when Walt sort of started like playing on his addiction and his earlier failures, and he was sounding very much like he sounded in the first two episodes when he was still nominally a chemistry teacher and Jesse was still nominally a dropout, you know, I thought that there was going to be some sort of like, again, a conflict between Walt and Jesse, but I kind of feel like they've played that card so often with the Jesse Walt clashes that the next one really, that if the next time they really throw down is going to have some sort of catastrophic result.
I agree, but that's also a sort of shot through the whole episode. There was definitely a feeling of menace. I mean, there always is, but it, even more so, I thought, because it was very clear something was going to happen. But Chuck, I'd love to get your take on this. Just, you know, one of the things that I've been writing about this season was, you know, Vince Gilligan has been pretty fearless about pushing this to the furthest point, you know, furthest extreme, both the character and the sort of story that he wanted to tell. And part of that is quite clearly that everything is just super dark, and we're not just talking about the complete lack of light bulbs in the White House at this point. Part of that means that not only is our main character turned very clearly into kind of a monster, but all of the people around him are being slowly picked off, whether they're quitting like Jesse or being literally picked off like Mike, and we're sort of becoming more and more isolated like the character. Are you enjoying this as a narrative experience, or do you feel like a part of you, I mean, because part of my experience that I'm sort of wrestling with is that on some level the show is less enjoyable than it was last year when there were more colorful characters all around and it seemed less completely bleak and hopeless.
That's interesting. I guess as a narrative experience, I am enjoying it more. I like what's happening with Walt as a viewer. Like, you know, because the thing is, that there's this question, like, you know, okay, can we still root for this guy? He's clearly evil now or whatever. But I'm rooting for the show. I like the show. And for the show to continue, Walt must continue to succeed. So I want him to succeed. I continue to support him in these venues.
You support his Blue Ice manufacturing.
Yes, and even sort of his Jesse is by far now the most likable character on that show. But if a situation, if in order for the narrative to continue, Walt must kill Jesse. He must do it.
Yeah, but then Chuck, with knowing then that there are only what 9 episodes left. Would you know? Do you find what's a satisfactory ending for you then? If you're chiefly concerned with the show's staying on or continuing, and you want to see Walt keep going on this sort of like dark path as long as it continues the show, which in the context of this conversation we're talking about, because obviously there's only so much more they can do. But what would you say if it was like if Jesse did convince Walt? If Jesse had said to Walt, "Hey, look, we made more money than we ever thought we would. $5 million is a lot. Let's just get out of it." Or if Mike had actually said to Walt beforehand, "You know what, man, we had a great good thing with Gus. let's just get out. And Walt takes the $5 million, and the rest of the last remaining episodes are just all about Walt and Jesse trying to matriculate back into quote-unquote normal life.
Well, you know, that's what I initially thought was going to happen with the trajectory of this show. What I thought the show was going to be was that Walt goes from being a chemistry teacher, you know, quote-unquote breaks bad, has this weird sort of venture into a life of crime, and then tries to get back into his old life, because I think it's in like maybe the fifth or sixth episode of the series, at one point he's talking to Jesse, they're out like sitting on like the bumper of their cars or something, and Jesse actively says like, you can't break bad like that, you just can't become bad and then be the person you were. So for the longest time, I assumed that the show was actually going to be about the transformation of this person from a good person to a bad person, and then his inability to return to the previous state. Well, that's clearly not going to happen now. He's just going to keep getting worse and worse and worse. So if you ask me, like, what would be a satisfactory ending, this is a very strange answer. But I just hope that whatever the ending is completely matches whatever it is Vince Gilligan intends.
Hmm.
My fear is that, for whatever reason, somehow whatever he wants to be the conclusion of the show will get changed, for whatever reason.
Who could possibly change it?
I think at this point, probably not. I'm working almost from the mindset of how television used to be.
That's right.
Where it could be possible, where someone could say, like, this is, you know, you can't have, like, let's say Vince Gilligan's idea is that the show is going to end with essentially every character dying, but Walt getting away with it and Walt being rich. Now, I think there was a time when the kind of people who controlled these decisions might have said, you can't do that. That's almost a betrayal to the audience because you're punishing them for having rooting for this. You know, although that wouldn't happen now.
Those same people who wouldn't let that happen would never have greenlit a show about a sympathetic crystal meth dealer. You know, I mean, all those rules about the morality of these things, I mean, it just wouldn't work. And it's actually, when you mention that, it brings up something that I think Chris and I are going to end up talking about more in the couple weeks to come. But I've been watching some of the pilots for the network shows, and it's just still remarkable. I mean, people talk about how, I think this is the first year at the Emmys where all of the drama series nominated are cable shows. And it's, and people have said that, you know, it's just not fair. Network shows can't compete because cable shows have, you know, very limited seasons, like 10, 13 episodes. It's possible to make something very taut and driven, as opposed to a network model. You have to make like 22, and there's inevitably going to be some stinkers. But the other thing about it that's totally out of whack, and I don't think you can ever make up the difference, is that a show, Fox has a drama coming out that Chris is very excited about called The Mob Doctor.
Mob Doctor.
And you'll never guess what it's about. But anyway, you watch it, or I watched it, and it's so bad, not only in and of itself, but it's very bad because we've seen shows about actual gangsters before. And on this show, because it's on a network, first of all, you have gangsters who call people things like trash pails, which is not really a cool insult, I don't think, in the mob world. But two, it follows this sort of very creaky general audience script technique where everyone has to be sympathetic a little bit, and then if someone's bad, they have to get rapped on the knuckles. You know, it sort of has to walk us through the morality of the characters very early on in order for us to root for them at all. The show would be much more interesting if the show was about a woman who grew up around people in the mob, liked them, and enjoyed helping them. But instead, she can't be that.
I would be interested in what both of you guys have, and not to cut you off, let me finish first before I cut you off.
No, I was just going to say that that to me is a much more interesting show and probably a more cable show about a young woman who really enjoys working, you know, helping out criminals, and maybe she grew up with them. Instead, she grew up with them, but was sort of in order to save her brother, had to agree to a deal to help out the mob and would never do it otherwise. And that's just sort of not nearly as interesting.
But I mean, is from a critic's perspective, is the argument we've seen this before a good argument? Because the fact of the matter is that, yes, you have seen these things before, but there's always a new audience of people who have not. And in order to appreciate what's different about cable programming, they first have to sort of see the way it is conventionally done. I mean, like with music, when we review records, we often would complain about things in that they seem like kind of like, you know, derivative of some earlier artist or some earlier
but
album.
Wouldn't we always just be praising things, like when we were writing record reviews? It's like, if they were derivative of things we happened to enjoy a lot, and we felt like the way that they paid homage to those things was enjoyable. I mean, it's not like the White Stripes were any... They sound a lot like Led Zeppelin, but we all like Led Zeppelin, so we were very forgiving of that, right?
Well, but also the argument I would make, Chuck, is that I feel like it's not just that have we seen it before, it's that we've seen it before done well. You know, I feel like that would be the key distinction.
Well, yeah, but that, well, I guess I'm not really even disagreeing with you. I'm just kind of bringing this point up, though. But I wonder if the idea is that if you make a show that seems like it's the old model, will that not appeal to people who don't have the history with television that you do?
Oh, right. Well, okay. Well, I think this is going to be a conversation that will definitely continue in the future. But I would say the thing is, one of the nice things about watching some of the pilots for The Fall, well, there's been nice things and bad things. The bad thing is that there are shows that are bad television, and they're bad television now, and they're bad in a way that would have been bad 10 years ago or 20 years ago. I mean, there's a Reba McEntire sitcom called Malibu Country that is just a terrible sitcom that could have been produced any of the last 50 years, basically. But there's also a show called Nashville, which has nothing to do with the Altman movie, that's coming out on ABC, and it's sort
that's
of
supposed
a
to be
big,
very good. Yeah.
And it's sort of a big soap opera set in, you know, in Music City, and it stars Connie Britton from Friday Night Lights. And it is in no way groundbreaking. It is in no way something that would or should be greenlit by HBO or AMC. It does almost nothing new at all. But I loved it because it hits beats that are very familiar and comforting and that really only network TV does well. And it's very entertaining, and it's just done, you know, it's produced at a very high quality. And that was very refreshing to see, that it's not just that, you know, we can't enjoy a show unless there's some sort of, the main character has some sort of dark, complicated morality or secret. You know, everything doesn't have to sort of follow The Sopranos, Wire, or Mad Men template.
I know, but aren't you to a degree making a semantic argument? To call one thing derivative and call something else familiar, isn't that just taking the same word and having one in the pejorative and one in the positive?
Totally, yeah. Well, I like things that are derivative. I mean, I like Interpol, you know? I mean, I have no problem with things that sound like other things or look like other things. You're right to catch me on that. I guess it's just the problem with The Mob Doctor isn't that we've, quote, seen it before. It's that it's trying to tell a story, and it's doing it both poorly and in a way that pales in comparison, probably partly because of audience restrictions, it pales in comparison to versions we've seen very recently.
Yeah.
I like the sound of Chuck thinking about my response is riveting. Do you accept that?
Oh, I accept.
All right, I appreciate it.
Well, I think we've definitely covered a lot of ground, guys.
Chuck, what do you think? Do you have any other ombudsman of the Hollywood Prospectus podcast? Do you want to just take us to task for anything? Anything else?
Take you to task. I don't know. How do you guys feel the book club is working?
Great.
Well, yeah.
No, I'm saying, like, do you? How much response are you getting from it?
Oh, a pretty fair amount.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I would say that my favorite thing that's happened pretty much since Grantland is in the fact that, like, you know, there are these books that we love and other people love, but Chris and I always would get really excited about, and then we've gotten a chance to get really excited about them during our jobs, which is super fun, and then people tweeted us or leave comments or whatever saying that they are reading them and, like, actually reading them and discovering these books.
Well, that's what I meant. I wonder how much, I mean, especially for some of these authors, you know, these books, a lot of the books you talk about would otherwise sort of be lost to culture. And I'm wondering if some of these books, you know, if they're, you know, I think, you ever checked, like, the Amazon numbers after you've talked about a book?
Oh, I wouldn't know about that.
I mean, I don't know. I mean, I know, like, certainly with, like, John D. MacDonald, and I recommended all 23 of his books. You know,
I think you guys should, because if you look, you know, especially with books that don't sell that much, if they would sell 10 more copies in a day, the Amazon number might go down more than you would imagine, because there's so many books tied.
It's true. I mean, I don't think we're quite on Oprah Book Club level yet, but it's, you know, it's really fun, also because just, and Chuck, you could probably speak to this too, but a lot of culture is very, very overcovered, but books are probably lag behind. So there's something a lot more pure and just exciting and fun to be able to share this. And it's sort of, it's interesting though, the timing is not really in sync with what we do on a day-to-day basis, because it's not like you can watch a YouTube video and be done with it. I mean, people are slowly finding these books, then it takes people different speeds to read them. But the feedback's been amazing, and would be even more amazing if Chris and I ever updated our Tumblr about it.
Well, thanks for joining us this week, Chuck. And Andy and I will be back next week to discuss the finale of Breaking Bad.
Thanks, Chuck. This was fun.
I appreciate it.
Thanks, buddy.
We'd like to thank you for listening to today's show. For more great podcasts, check out the Pod Center page at ESPNradio.com.
Okay.